Okay, so my guest today is Ruben Binns. Ruben is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Computer Science in Oxford. His research focuses on both the technical, ethical, and legal aspects of privacy, machine learning, and algorithmic decision making. So I'd just like to welcome you to the show, Ruben.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Ruben, I invited you on the show today to talk primarily about fairness and accountability in algorithmic decision making. So this is a topic that has exercised quite a number of people in recent years. Several books have been authored with alarming titles that speak to the alleged unfairness or bias of algorithmic decision making. These include books like Weapons of Math Destruction by Cathy O'Neill, Automating Inequality by Virginia Eubanks, and Algorithms of Oppression by Sophia Nobel. Now, at least some researchers and developers in the field of machine learning and algorithmic decision making are conscious of the problems of bias and unfairness and have been working to try and eliminate them from the systems that they create. Now, you recently wrote an excellent paper on this topic called Fairness in Machine Learning, Lessons from Political Philosophy, which tries to join together the technical debates about debiasing algorithms with some of the classic philosophical debates about what it means for a decision to be fair. So what I want to do is spend most of our time today exploring the arguments and ideas from this particular paper, maybe coming back to some of your other work on accountability and algorithmic decision-making towards the end, if we have time. So I usually like to start with some kind of general orientating questions, and they usually tend to be definitional, so I won't change the formula for this particular conversation. So you're focusing on the ethics of algorithmic decision-making. But what do you mean by algorithmic decision-making, and could you give an example of the phenomenon that you're concerned with?
So algorithmic decision-making is a slightly fuzzy term, but I think the way that most people who are using it in this space have intended it to mean, it has a few elements. So it involves a computer program, which takes some inputs about a situation and then deterministically produces an output based on those inputs. And that output might be used possibly with some human interpretation to determine a decision. So, for example, an algorithmic decision-making system for personalized adverts might take some features about a customer's behavior as input and then produce an output that might be a prediction about what kind of product that consumer might be interested in.
Yeah, so it usually involves making some sort of classification or prediction based on previous data inputs by a user.
Correct, yeah.
Now, I mean, in your paper on fairness, it is conspicuously titled, I think, Fairness in Machine Learning. So is machine learning something that is distinct from algorithmic decision making? Is it a subtype of algorithmic decision making? How do you understand those differences?
So I'd probably say it's a subtype, and I'd say it differs from other forms in a few ways. So generally involves spotting patterns in data sets, rather than explicitly programming rules, which is what previous forms of artificial intelligence did. So rather than a human programmer writing a piece of code that says, you know, if customer brought strawberries, then suggest cream. Instead of that, there's a learning algorithm which identifies statistical relationships between customers buying strawberries and then going on to buy cream.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the debates around the use of machine learning in decision-making context is that it leads to a certain degree of opacity in decision-making. I mean, how does that arise? How does that happen?
So I suppose one reason for that is that you can feed data to a machine learning algorithm and it will produce a model. And without really looking at how that model is working, you wouldn't necessarily know how it arrived at the output. There are methods to analyze this. So you can look at the coefficients in a linear model, for instance, or you can perturb the inputs and see what impact they have on the output. Generally speaking, out of the box, there are no kind of automatic explanation features that are attached to models.
I mean, just one kind of clarificatory point as well about the phenomenon that we're discussing. I mean, if we're focusing on machine learning as a subtype, I think it's pretty clear that we're dealing with a technologized form of algorithmic decision making. But, you know, one thing that I'm often criticized about in talks that I give about this phenomenon is that people will say, well, isn't all decision making algorithmic in some sense? And, you know, hasn't bureaucratic decision making been algorithmic for centuries or generations, at least? So, you know, what's so new and special or different this time around? I mean, do you have an answer to that question? Is there something importantly distinct about modern technologized forms of algorithmic decision making?
I mean, I suppose on one level that critique is true. You know, there's Max Weber talked about bureaucratic decision making in being a sort of very formulaic or algorithmic form of decision making. So there is certainly that critique has got an element of truth. I think there are some differences, though. One is the types of data that can be used. So there is massive amounts of digitally generated data, which aren't always well understood. And there's also the ability to spot patterns automatically, which I think is a step change in comparison to the forms of decision making that were made before, where you might have, say, a bunch of scientists come up with a study that shows some correlation between one variable and another variable. But with machine learning, you have the ability to do that at a massive scale with many more variables at the same time.
Yeah, I suspect also, depending on the infrastructure, you can do this in real time, and it can be updated faster right. and more efficiently than a traditional bureaucratic decision-making system, which, of course, famously are criticized for being slow and cumbersome and so forth.
Exactly.
Okay, so, I mean, let's move on then to talk about fairness in algorithmic decision-making. So as I mentioned at the outset, there are a bunch of people who are very concerned about this. I mean, could we have an example of alleged unfairness or bias in an algorithmic decision-making process? I mean, there have been some famous illustrations of this, but, you know, what are some of the good examples of this?
So, I mean, there's a very well-discussed example, which I'm often loath to use, but I think is a good pedagogical example, I suppose we could say, and that's the COMPASS system. And so the COMPASS system is a system used in some US courts, and what it does is it provides judges with a risk score, which is supposed to represent the probability that a convicted felon who is up for parole will reoffend if the judge decides to release them. And so the score is based on 137 different features about the defendant. So things like the defendant's age, what crime they have been charged with, prior offences, whether they were raised in a single parent home, whether other members of their family have ever been arrested, and so on. And if the defendant has a high risk score, according to the algorithm, then the judge may be less likely to grant parole. And one of the reasons this is kind of controversial is that a team of journalists and statisticians from a US news organization called ProPublica, they tested the algorithm on a data set of 10,000 criminal defendants from a place called Broward County in Florida. This data set included the answers to the COMPASS questionnaire, and it also detailed whether each defendant went on to commit a crime. And so they ran this data through the COMPASS algorithm to see what risk scores it gave to different types of people. And the team found that, at least in one respect, this algorithm appears to treat black and white defendants quite differently. So of all those black defendants who ultimately didn't go on to reoffend, a larger proportion of them were incorrectly classified as high risk compared to the white defendants.
Yeah, so, I mean, this debate has kind of gone back and forth. This is maybe 3 years old, in fact. I think the original paper was 2015. I want to come back in a moment to why you're loath to discuss this, because I'm interested in your opinion. But, I mean, just to clarify for people who are listening to it what the debate was about, my understanding of it, and you can correct me if I'm incorrect about this, was that the makers of this system, the COMPASS algorithm, defended it on the grounds that the accuracy rate for defendants was equivalent. I mean, it didn't vary that much depending on whether you were white or black. So roughly speaking, about 60% of the time that it classified a defendant as being at a high risk of recidivism, they did in fact go on to commit another crime. And that it pans out in the data set that the journalists from ProPublica used and discussed in their piece. They were arguing that it was unfair and discriminatory because if you were a black defendant, you were far more likely to have a false positive classification.
Correct, yeah.
I think it was like a 47% risk. Yeah. And if you're a white defendant, you're far more likely to be given a false negative classification. Right. I can't remember what the figure was off the top of my head. And now the company's defense of that was probably two defenses that they have. One was that, well, there's just a higher kind of base rate of recidivism among black defendants anyway, so you couldn't completely kind of eliminate this problem if you were trying to equalize the accuracy rate. And they, in most of their conversations, they say that they're guided by kind of U.S. Supreme Court law on this, which is that they have to have an equalized accuracy rate between the two groups of defendants. Is that roughly what's going on in that debate?
Yeah, that's a fair summary, I think. And it's worth sort of pointing out that this debate came to a standoff between ProPublica and Northpoint, the makers of the Compass algorithm, a bunch of different academic teams then stepped in to say, well, actually, these two definitions of fairness you've given are mutually incompatible, except in very rare circumstances where the base rates of recidivism are equal across different populations between risk bands. And so the impossibility proof that these academics produced is written up as a mathematical proof. But if you think about a very simple version of the Compass algorithm, you can get a sense of why that has to be the case. So if you think about a system which has just two labels, low risk or high risk, and imagine that, say, 60% of the defendants in the low risk category don't reoffend, 60% in the high risk category do reoffend, and imagine that the judge always releases defendants in the low risk category, then we know that in 4 out of 10 of the cases where defendants are deemed high risk, they won't go on to reoffend. So those cases will be false positives, and that will be to the detriment of the 40% of the people who are deemed high risk, who in the end didn't reoffend. And now imagine that there are more people of a particular race in that category. It's guaranteed that there will be a higher false positive rate for those people overall, the system overall. So yeah, you can either make sure that black and white defendants in the same risk band are equally likely to reoffend, or you can equalize the false positive rate between racial groups across the whole model. But unless the distribution of racial groups between risk bands is exactly the same, which is very unlikely, then you can't do both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, so there's kind of a hard choice or a trade-off to be made when it comes to, you know, deciding what kind of bias or unfairness you're trying to eliminate in your model.
Right, right. And there are a few things which kind of this debate doesn't really touch on, which I think are important to bear in mind about this specific case. So obviously, first of all, we don't know which of the defendants actually go on to reoffend. What we have is the data on those who reoffend and got caught. So if, for instance, if black defendants are more likely to get caught reoffending than whites, then we can't take those reported reoffense rates at face value. And the other thing is that many of these 137 different questions on the Compass test concern things like whether someone was raised by a single parent or if their family members have been arrested. So these are things that aren't in the control of the individuals. And actually, a recent study showed that you could get a system that had exactly the same accuracy as the Compass system whilst only using two different features. So I think the features were age and number of convictions. And so in that case, you might say, well, all these other problematic variables that they were using might not even be necessary for the same level of accuracy.
Yeah, but I mean, that would be a problem with, I guess, the survey or the data that they're using. Maybe some of it is irrelevant or redundant or something, but that wouldn't eliminate the kind of deeper problem that they were criticized for.
Right, yeah. Right.
Okay. So, I mean, you say you were loath to use the example. I mean, you gave some kind of criticisms or reasons why the example's problematic. Are there other reasons why you are loath to use this example?
I mean, one is just it's been used so much. I think another reason I'm slightly wary of it is that it's become such a well-defined and constrained problem, which is purely looking at this debate between equalizing false positive rates or equalizing the predictive parity in different risk bands, that it constrains the debate somewhat. And I think it makes it seem as if it's a problem that needs to be fixed at the level of adding certain constraints to the model building process or adding certain constraints to the system itself, when actually the problems, I think, are much wider beyond it. And I think most people kind of get that on an intuitive level, but the debate tends to get stuck in this question about what formal constraints should we place on the algorithm itself.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, this is kind of one of the functions of your paper then, is to maybe go into some of the broader background considerations that should be kind of guiding the debate, rather than focusing on the very particular details of how you construct the model, answering some preliminary philosophical questions first.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Because in a sense, and like this is just the kind of bottom line summary of that whole debate, I think, is that the concern is that the model is baking in or hardwiring in some pre-existing structural inequality between black and white defendants. And sure, it's accurate, but you probably need to ask the... but you need to ask the kind of deeper question about the kind of background conditions of inequality as well before you can really kind of determine whether the system is fair or unfair.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any other examples of unfairness in algorithmic decision making that you like to use or have come to mind?
Other things I've looked at have been employment decisions, whether that's hiring or promotion. There are cases like credit scoring, which have been examined. There's obviously predictive policing, which is a bit closer to the Compass case. But there are many, many different areas. But tends to be the case that when you look at them, they become more complicated and quickly people start to think about the broader social implications rather than the algorithms themselves.
Okay, I mean, so let's go into some of the philosophical questions that you raise in your paper. I mean, just starting out, there's, I think, an interesting assumption underlying your paper. I mean, I don't know if this is a fair summary of your view, but I'll just make the claim anyway and see what you think, which is that you seem to be suggesting that we need to look to the philosophical literature to shed light on the, or to aid the technical discussion of fairness and unfairness. And like, while in principle I agree with that notion, at first glance it's a very inauspicious hope, I think, that we'll find any clarity from the philosophical literature, because the philosophical literature itself is massively contentious and confused and filled with contradictory competing theories.
Yeah. I guess it would provide clarity about the nature of our unclarity, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, I think. All right, so, I mean, the first part of your paper looks at the notion of discrimination in algorithmic decision-making. So one of the arguments that you make here is that machine learning-based decision-making may not be discriminatory, at least not in the sense that philosophers care about discrimination. So I want to try and explore that argument, and I think it helps initially if we try and define or understand what discrimination is, because I think you draw a contrast between discrimination and fairness more generally. So like, what is that contrast or distinction?
It's a tricky one. I think the way that the literature from political and legal philosophy on discrimination is, it seems like there's a lot of disagreement about the term. There are some people who think that discrimination is a particular subset of egalitarian concerns, others who think it's completely separate. Many people start with the quote from Aristotle, which is something to the effect that fairness or justice means treating like cases alike and unalike cases differently to the extent that they are unalike. So a kind of a very basic definition of discrimination would be that it occurs when two people who are alike get treated differently. But obviously, you know, in one sense, algorithmic decision making trivially meets this constraint because it's deterministic. So if you put in the same inputs, you'll get the same output. But really, this definition begs the broader question, which is, well, which differences between people are legitimate grounds for different treatment and which are not. And that's kind of, I think, what a lot of the debate around discrimination ends up being about in practice.
Yeah, I mean, this might end up conflating it a little bit with egalitarian concerns more generally, but I suppose one way of thinking about it is that, I mean, people are multidimensional, that there are lots of factors or criteria that characterize or define any particular individual. So they'll differ along some dimensions and they'll be maybe similar along other dimensions. But in cases of discrimination, you are treating people who might be unlike along some dimensions, but those dimensions aren't considered to be important to the particular decision-making context. But you're kind of using them as criteria for making a choice when you shouldn't be using them as criteria for making a choice. So again, you know, in a hiring decision, you're focusing on the skin color of an applicant for a job and using that as a criteria for making a choice rather than their fitness for work or something like that.
Right.
Okay. Now there are different theories about why discrimination in decision-making is a problem in philosophy. So, I mean, one theory is that it has to do with the mental state of the person making the choice. Could you maybe explain that theory of discrimination?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, essentially it comes down to the idea that in order for discrimination to occur, it has to be the result of something going on in the mind of the decision maker. So that might be a certain attitude of animosity towards someone on the basis of their membership of a certain group, so whether they may be gender or race or other things.
Yeah, so it's some kind of prejudice or a negative attitude towards a group classification or a membership of a group.
Right.
Right. So that could either be a genuine malice towards a group, or could it also include things like, this probably draws us into debates about indirect discrimination, which I'll perhaps leave to one side for the time being, because I think we come back to that in a moment. So, I mean, this involves some kind of prejudicial attitude, mental attitude among in the decision maker. So, right. Now, you can probably, anyone listening to this can imagine how the argument would pan out from here, but let's just spell it out. I mean, you say algorithmic decisions can't be discriminatory according to this theory. So why is that?
So the main reason I point to in the paper is that algorithmic systems don't have those kinds of mental states, right? So a machine learning model is just a way of mapping a certain input space to a certain output space based on the statistical patterns that it's observed. And I'm not a philosopher of mind, but as far as I understand that field, most people working in it would hold that more is required before we can attribute mental states to computers. So especially if we're talking about mental states like contempt or animosity. And so, yeah, that's the basic kind of argument why we shouldn't impute that form of discrimination to systems.
Yeah, so until we have created a kind of fully human equivalent, artificially intelligent decision maker, we're not going to really be in a position to ascribe these kinds of mental states to the outputs of algorithmic decision making systems. However, I mean, there's maybe another way of looking at this, which is that, you know, these systems have creators and designers. So couldn't we just trace the relevant mental states back to those designers or creators? I mean, just as an aside here, that's a common enough phenomenon in other areas of the law where we attribute liability to somebody for choices or decisions made by an agent of theirs or a proxy of theirs in some way.
Yeah, and I think that's a reasonable kind of line of argument. And I would say that if it were the case that a designer of a system is confronted by, let's say, you know, some journalists who have done an analysis like the ProPublica one and shown that their system has these problems, and then they say, well, yeah, I don't really care because I don't really care about those people, then of course we can then start talking again about certain mental states that they might have that would qualify it as a discriminatory system, perhaps. I certainly think that designers and implementers of those systems have moral duty, and in some cases legal duty, to prevent harmful effects. But it's not as if the individual decisions are being directly made by them. Another line of interesting argument would be not to look at the designers of the systems, but to look at the humans who are involved in making the data that the systems learn from, right? So there's a potential that we could say, well, if the data itself reflects the mental states of prejudiced human beings, then maybe the model inherits discrimination from those people who had a role in making the data the way it is. And there's kind of interesting research in social epistemology, which deals with the idea that groups could have mental states that are in some way derived from but not reducible to those of their members. And so we might argue that perhaps the data set on criminal offences that's used to train the Compass algorithm might reflect possible discriminatory mental states of, say, police officers in the district that data is drawn from. And I think that's an interesting possible argument that I kind of note in the paper, but I haven't pursued it in detail thus far.
Yeah, I mean, my mind is instantly drawn to the example of, you know, the Microsoft Tau chatbot on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Who
yeah.
was fed, well, I mean, this is one of the arguments anyway that Microsoft made, I think, in defense of it, was that she, in inverted commas there, was fed a lot of kind of racist memes or language, and that's why she became racist in her conversations, but that was a function of the humans that were inputting the data.
Yeah, yeah. And at that point, I don't know if it becomes a purely semantic distinction between the algorithm is racist, or, you know, it's following out the racism of the users.
Yeah, although presumably, like, that's kind of what, you know, a lot of people who are interested in social justice and discrimination believe or hold, which is that, you know, society is structurally or institutionally or collectively racist. So we all have some kind of blame to be shared in these systems. So I can see maybe that being an attractive kind of argument to people.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
And that, of course, leads us into the second type of discrimination, which you talk about in the paper, which is a more kind of statistical theory or model of discrimination or understanding of what makes discrimination wrong. So maybe you could just explain what that theory says about discrimination, and then we can consider the application.
Sure. So the idea of statistical discrimination is, I think, derives from economists, and it kind of describes situations where an employer, say, wants to hire someone, and it's expensive to test everyone individually, and it's cheaper to make guesses about how good someone's going to be on the job based on the characteristics that they share in common with other applicants who are good. And so one reason this seems unfair is that it's not the individual qualities of a candidate that get them the job, but rather the features that they share with other people who were bad at the job that might cost them the opportunity to get invited to an interview or even to make to get the job in the end.
Yeah, so you're using kind of heuristics or rules of thumb about people who are similar to the applicant, what they tend to be like, and kind of using that then as a decision-making tool. So, you know, all Oxford graduates should get the jobs in government, or if you come from, you know, Balliol College in Oxford, you should be the prime minister. And that's the kind of thing that's going on here, is that you're not focusing really on the merits of the applicant. You're focusing on these generalized properties.
Yeah.
And I mean, so you could link this to a kind of Kantian theory of moral wrongness, I suppose, which is that we should be treating individuals as ends in themselves, as kind of unique beings, as opposed to members of classes.
Right.
Now, I mean, this seems like it could pose a big problem for algorithmic decision making, because I think you use the language in the paper that algorithmic decision making could be regarded as a form of generalization on steroids. So maybe explain that idea.
Sure. I guess what I was trying to get at there is that it's all about generalization, and it's generalization of a form that humans aren't equipped to even do them by themselves. So if in at one level, it's essentially the same as what you're doing if you plot a graph with, you know, the relationship between two variables, and you try and draw a line between the points and on the scatter plot, and the aim is to kind of minimize the distance of all of the points from the line that you draw through them. With machine learning, you've got not just straight lines through 2D plots, but you've got non-monotonic, which means like lines that go up and down, and not just 2D, but kind of multi-dimensional spaces where you have multiple different variables and you're trying to draw lines between them in a multi-dimensional space. So it's kind of, it's a step change in the amount of generalization that's going on in terms of the complexity.
Yeah, I mean, the day that we're recording this, a couple of days ago, maybe at the weekend, this guy, Michael Kosinski, is it?
Right.
So he's famous for using kind of Facebook-like data to kind of generate predictions about people. So I suppose his most controversial example is like figuring out whether somebody is homosexual based on the kinds of things that they liked on Facebook. And that involves this kind of multidimensional principal component analysis, I think, is the approach that he takes, right? So it's generalizing from that kind of data set to make predictions about specific individuals.
That's right, yeah.
So I might put a link to some of his work and some of the debates that it's generated. Nevertheless, you make the argument that even though algorithmic decision-making probably does involve this kind of generalization on steroids, they shouldn't necessarily be criticized for under the terms of the statistical theory of discrimination. Why do you believe that?
So I think the problem for an account which purely tries to place the problem of discrimination in terms of generalization is that it is too strong. And it fails to distinguish between generalizations that are based on protected characteristics like gender, race, religion, and so on, and those based on other characteristics like, if we're talking about workplace, we might be thinking about attendance rates or on-the-job training, or maybe in the Compass case, we're thinking about prior convictions. I think most of us would agree that the former characteristics are unacceptable basis for generalizations, but that the latter case, so things like attendance rates or qualifications, are at least prima facie a fair thing to generalize based on, at least provided that they're relevant to the decision in question, and also that they're not proxies for the protected characteristics.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the fears about the Compass system, is that maybe the data on whether a family member went to prison or whether you came from a single parent home, these things were kind of proxies for protected characteristics like skin color or race.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, you also make the argument, which you take from, I think, the work of Frederick Schauer, which is that, you know, it's basically impossible to avoid making some kinds of generalizations when you're making decisions. And there's a nice example of that in your paper. Maybe you could kind of outline that.
I can't remember the exact example that I used, but I remember that Schauer uses an example. He's a law professor. So he uses the example of the bar exam, which you have to sit and pass if you want to become a lawyer. And he says, you know, this is a form of generalization from people who passed the exam to on-the-job performance, right? It's a form of generalization. But it's on the face of it, it seems okay. So what's the difference? It begs the question, what's the difference between generalizing based on score in the bar exam versus generalization on protected characteristics?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess like part of the reason why we think the generalization from the bar exam is useful is that it somehow tracks an important predictive variable, that it genuinely tells you something meaningful about a person's outcome in life. And that, so as long as we focus on those kinds of criteria, those kinds of generalizations, it's okay. But the problem then is that, of course, people would argue that focusing on some of the protected characteristics, those variables, also is accurate and predictive. But we've decided to exclude those from the kinds of things you can take into consideration for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so like, I guess to use a controversial example, somebody like, let's say, Charles Murray will say that IQ, or sorry, race is predictive of IQ, which is in turn predictive of a number of social outcomes. And you know, I don't have any particular view on whether that's true or not, but if it was true, it means that the protective characteristic of race would actually have some predictive value, but we are excluding it from the kinds of things you can take into consideration, even though it might be predictive. Okay. So, I mean, your defense of algorithms, assuming they don't factor in these protective characteristics or proxies for them, they're entitled to rely upon some kinds of generalizations, because generalizations are valuable and also unavoidable to some extent. But a lot of this does depend, I think, heavily on the accuracy of the generalizations that they use. So is it dangerous to assume that algorithms are going to be accurate in their generalizations?
So I guess what I'm not saying is that algorithms would be more fair if they were more accurate. And that might be true in some cases, but false in others. So it depends on how the accuracy gains are distributed amongst different populations. So if, for instance, North Point, the company that make the Compass algorithm, if they were able to improve the accuracy of the algorithm by, let's say, reducing the number of white defendants who were incorrectly given high-risk scores, then that would increase the accuracy, but it would also result in even bigger disparities in the false positive rates between black and white defendants. So in that case, higher accuracy wouldn't always mean a more fair system. So I think, yeah, there are these tensions between accuracy and fairness. And ideally, we hope that we can improve accuracy while at the same time improving fairness, but it might not always be the case.
Yeah, so again, there might be these important trade-offs to be made between different values, different considerations, between accuracy and overall fairness. I mean, one thing that I just wanted to mention, I don't know if this is it's not necessarily a counter-argument to your position or anything, but I just wanted to discuss it because I don't know what I think about it. It's just that, I mean, one reason why we don't like generalizations, it's not just to do with protective characteristics and maybe, you know, historical oppression or inequality. Excuse me. It's also to do with the idea that we don't like to think that we're fixed in a certain bubble or a certain box. And one of the fears that we might have about algorithmic decision-making is that it tends to perpetuate some kind of historical generalization that was true about us. I mean, I did use an example to you in an email that I sent to you about John Stuart Mill's argument in the subjection of women, but I don't want to use that argument because that kind of conflates or blends together concerns about historical oppression and inequality. So I wanted to use a more trivial example to express my thinking on this. So, you know, let's say I'm watching movies on Netflix and I watch a lot of romantic comedies, and I've watched maybe hundreds of romantic comedies on there. And so it kind of fits me in a box where it is true to say that I like romantic comedies, but maybe at some point in time, I don't want to be the kind of person who likes romantic comedies anymore. So I don't want to be constantly recommended or suggested romantic comedies. I don't want to be predictable in that way. I don't want to have this kind of ontological fixity about me that I am just necessarily a person who will always like romantic comedies. So, one fear we could have about the kinds of generalizations that algorithmic decision-making systems make, even if they are accurate about us, is that they assume or presume a kind of fixity in our character.
This is something that's kind of, I think, dealt with particularly well in the work of people like Murray Hildebrandt, who studies philosophy of law and technology. In that work, she tends to characterize those things in terms of autonomy and diversity the ability to resist profiling. As you say, the concern here is that technologies might preempt people's tastes and preferences based on things that other people like them did or things that they did in the past, and then kind of steer them towards those tastes and preferences rather than others that they might have found their way towards if they'd been left alone. So this creates a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy and a feedback loop which perpetuates patterns of behavior from the past. And so, it's problematic both for the individual for their own autonomy. They should be allowed to follow their own tastes in ways that kind of emerge in a more random way. But it's also potentially negative for society because it potentially limits the amount of intellectual or creative diversity, which can bring lots of public benefits.
Yeah, I mean, the way I was thinking about it myself was that it's kind of like a type of a form of typecasting, or
right.
You're stuck in a role permanently. You know, I'm thinking of like William Shatner always complained about the fact that he was typecast by playing Captain Kirk, and and that he had much more range as an actor. Maybe that's true. I think a lot of people might disagree about the range of his acting, but it's an equivalent problem that we might all end up like William Shatner, in a sense, fated to play a certain part by these systems. I mean, is there a way of designing that out of systems just by introducing some kind of randomness?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a whole field of recommender systems which aims to kind of generate serendipity, and there's kind of all sorts of arguments about how the hell you try and define serendipity in a mathematical way. But it's got something to do with, you know, things that are pleasing but in an unpredictable way, so in a way that goes against previous behavior. So there are kind of people trying to work on that in the recommender systems world.
Yeah, so I mean, there's kind of maybe a technical solution to that problem as well. Let's move on, though. I think we're maybe getting a little bit diverted from the main topic, which is on fairness and equality. So we've looked at discrimination, and I think the conclusion you reach at the end of your discussion on discrimination is that discrimination may not be the most important thing to focus on when we're thinking about the fairness of algorithmic decisions. We should probably focus on more general egalitarian concerns. So what do you mean by those more general egalitarian concerns? What are some examples of them?
This is kind of a topic that's dominated a lot of political philosophy, especially since the 70s, with people like John Rawls, who articulated this principles of distributive justice. And so really, these debates are about what does it mean for people to be treated equally, and also to what extent should we try to redistribute certain valuable things in society, whether that be income or wealth or status. And there are kind of different debates about what, if that's the case, what we should focus on. Should we focus on welfare, which is the extent to which people experience pleasure or satisfy their preferences? That's kind of associated with people like Jerry Cohen. For Rawls, it was about income and assets. For people like Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, the focus should be on capabilities. So people should have equal ability to do things and have the resources that they need to do certain things. And then yet other people talk about things like equal political and democratic status. And so all these different metrics or currencies of egalitarianism might result in subtly different ways of thinking about the harms and benefits implicated in algorithmic systems and what needs to be done to kind of correct those differences.
Right. I just want to kind of plant a flag because this is going to be important for the conversation as it develops from here. So this is one dimension of complexity when it comes to these more general theories of egalitarianism. It's, you know, what are we trying to distribute fairly amongst the members of society? Is it welfare? Is it income and assets? Is it capabilities and so forth? So mm-hmm. So there's these different choices that we have to make about what we are trying to equalize. We'll come back in a moment to other things that we need to bear in mind when focusing on fairness, which is maybe the history of a particular distribution in society. But if we focus just on those different currencies for the time being, you know, so what are some of the examples of how this could affect how we look at an algorithmic decision-making system? And will hard choices have to be made between these different currencies or metrics?
Right. So, I mean, it's a difficult one because many of these different metrics you could still kind of justify or disagree with the decision regardless of which of these metrics you choose. So in some cases, it doesn't seem to make much of a difference. But I think it's worth thinking about them, especially if you subscribe to the view that there are different spheres of justice. So this is a view associated with Michael Walzer, who believed that there are different spheres of justice in which different egalitarian norms or currencies might apply. So for instance, if we're thinking about the political sphere, if we're thinking about the right to vote, there's an egalitarian norm that everyone gets the right to vote, which is different to the egalitarian norm that exists in, say, employment, where not everyone has an equal right to the same job. Like some people deserve certain jobs because they are better at them, for instance. And so it's worth bearing in mind these different currencies of egalitarianism because algorithmic systems will be deployed in different contexts. And so in some cases, it might be entirely appropriate to completely equalize the odds, to completely equalize the treatment between different groups.
Okay, so I mean, there are these different spheres of decision-making and there are different things we could be trying to achieve across those different decision-making contexts. And so different metrics or currencies that are at use or at stake, political versus economic versus terrorism prevention and so forth. What about another factor that I think really impacts on our judgments of equality and fairness, and this features a lot in the philosophical literature, is, you know, judgments about luck and responsibility and desert. So what are some of the concerns there and how could they play out in this debate about algorithmic fairness?
Yeah, so I mean, so there's one theory which is called luck egalitarianism, and that's associated with people like Richard Arneson. This theory claims that we should aim to equalize inequalities between people, but only if they're the result of brute luck. So, for instance, if we have inequalities between people that are not their own choice, so, you know, some people have debilitating diseases that they had no hand in creating, then those inequalities should be equalized. On the other hand, if people are find themselves in unequal positions as a result of their own choices, then we shouldn't aim to equalize those differences. And then there are kind of cases in that are kind of a mixture of both luck and responsibility, where people end up in bad positions after voluntarily deciding to take a gamble. It's a risky gamble. And in those cases, we might want to compensate them a little bit, but not as much as if they ended up there through no fault of their own. Because we tend to believe that in some sense, people deserve to bear the cost of their gambles that they freely and autonomously make. And then there's kind of critiques of luck egalitarianism. For instance, there's a critique by Elizabeth Anderson, which is that it unduly punishes those who might voluntarily choose to put themselves in a worse off position, but they do so in order to help others. So some people have suggested a version of egalitarianism or luck egalitarianism in which people should bear the cost of inequalities that they have brought on themselves unless they did that in order to alleviate someone else's inequitable position.
Yeah, so I mean, if I forwent a lucrative career in investment banking in order to, I don't know, provide medical care to the sick and needy or the deprived, that I might have some loss in my overall level of well-being or something, but I deserve to be compensated maybe for that choice by society. That's yeah. The kind of the thing. And whereas other people have made choices that result in a worse outcome for them, but they don't deserve the compensation.
Right.
So I think probably one of the standard examples, which is controversial in itself, but anyway, in the luck egalitarianism literature is somebody who like smoked all their life, that they might deserve to be lower down the pecking order when it comes to access to healthcare because they made a certain choice that had negative effects on their health.
Right, right.
Assuming that they're not somebody who was misled, they chose to smoke with their eyes open, knowing what the consequences might be for their long-term health and well-being. So, yeah. I mean, there are all these factors that you have to bear in mind when you're making these assessments or judgments, and it becomes probably quite complex once you actually try and do it. But I mean, how does this play out then, or how might this play out in the algorithmic decision-making debate? I think you use an example again from the whole Compass debate to illustrate how this might have an impact on how we approach these things.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are clearly some variables or features in the Compass algorithm which are quite uncontroversially things that the defendants themselves didn't choose. So, you know, the number of family members who have had prior arrests, for instance, is clearly not going to fly on the luck egalitarian account. And then there might be some examples of things in that 137 point questionnaire, which might be choices, but might be choices that we don't necessarily want to punish. So, for instance, let's say you had the opportunity to live in a different area, like a low crime area, but you decided to stay in a high crime area in order to, say, look after your family or friends or do positive kind of work in the community, then you might be unfairly punished for that choice because of the predictive features of the predictive value for the North Points algorithm from being in that area.
I suppose that suggests to me that it's going to be very complex if we're going to try and incorporate those kinds of judgments into how we construct a model. So, I mean, just to stick with that example, does that mean that we just leave the question about where you live, your neighborhood, out of the model entirely, because there could be some people who have chosen to stay put for good reasons and there are other people who maybe haven't, but we have no way of discriminating between the two or deciding which a person is? Or does it mean that we have to kind of add complexity to the model so that we can be sensitive to that kind of difference between two individuals?
Yeah, I think that's true. So when you get into these debates, it may well be that the cost of acquiring the additional data or the additional investigation that you'd need to distinguish between those who chose their circumstances and those who didn't, or those who chose them for good reasons or bad reasons, that might just be too costly. And then the question is, well, do we prioritize the predictive value of that feature, or do we just say, no, let's not use it? It's too complicated, and the whatever value it has in terms of accuracy is not going to outweigh the problem that some people will be unfairly treated on the basis of those features.
Yeah, I suppose it's important that we're asking these questions and that they are brought into the minds of people who are developing these systems, but it might mean that we can't be sensitive to certain criteria or dimensions of fairness as much as we would, might like to be when we design or create these processes.
Exactly. That's the luxury that the philosophers have that the data scientists don't have.
Yeah, but I guess that's what makes this whole conversation interesting and why the philosophical analysis of it is worthwhile, is because you see how practicable in the real world some of these philosophical theories actually are.
Right.
I mean, so the other thing that you talk about, in addition to luck and fairness, and I'm not entirely sure how these things are distinct, even though I know that they are distinct in some people's minds, which is this notion of deontic justice, which you take from Parfit. So could you explain what that is, and then again how it plays out in this conversation?
Sure. So the term deontic justice was, as you say, introduced by Derek Parfit, and he introduced it in contrast to another kind of justice, which he called telic justice. So telic justice says that if some people are worse off than others, then that is in itself bad, regardless of the reasons for that. Whereas deontic justice says that, while unequal distributions are generally speaking unjust, it actually matters how those differences came about. And so I think this is an important aspect of the Compass debate and other debates. You know, there are historical reasons for the disparities between the black and white defendants in the Compass data set, and which arguably, you know, extend back through things like systemic racial injustice in the US, the denial of civil rights, and then you could ultimately trace it back to, you know, Western imperialism, colonialism, slavery, and so on. There's an interesting point that Caspar Lippert Rasmussen makes, which is that we can't use statistical facts to justify the fairness of certain predictions if those statistical facts are themselves the result of unjust social processes.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that kind of encompasses the same sorts of concerns that we were focusing on in the whole luck versus desert example, but we're kind of maybe generalizing it and looking at it as a more systematic problem. So it's the reasons why people are in different categories or different cohorts or different generalizations happen to be true about particular cohorts of people can be due to individual choices that they made, but can also be due to historical systems of oppression and structural problems in society. And so we need to be sensitive to those when we're designing a system. And yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, I think this is really kind of gets to the heart of the whole debate about the Compass algorithm, which was that the system is kind of perpetuating a structurally unjust social ordering.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is kind of where the philosophy and the computer science ends and history and sociology begins. The debate needs work from those fields to actually articulate these historical reasons for the statistical facts that the North Point algorithm is using.
So, I mean, you know, it's not like people are unaware of those historical facts, or, I mean, you'd have to be an extremely isolated or blinkered data scientist to not have some awareness of them. So, why aren't people taking those things into consideration? Or, again, is it just too difficult to build that into your model, or are they incentivized not to? What seems to be the issue with that?
I mean, I think to some extent, the companies that are building these models genuinely don't want to acknowledge some of the structural biases that go into making up the data that they're using. But even for those who do, I guess one of the challenges is that it's very hard to quantify, well, okay, maybe some of the reason for the disparities in distributions of people of different populations is to do with that, but how much of it, right? So if you need to formally put a constraint on your model, you need to answer difficult questions which are not fully answerable by social science. And so that becomes a politically contentious thing to do. And I think especially private companies would be very reluctant to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine why they would be. You know, one of the final points you make in your paper on fairness is about a distinction between, you know, fair distribution and fair representation, and how this is also something that we should factor in when thinking about algorithmic decision making. So, you know, what is that distinction again, and how does it affect our thinking here?
So yeah, there's this distinction between fair distribution, which you could think of as the kinds of things we've been talking about already. So how should valuable resources be distributed amongst the population? And then a separate thing, which is about equal recognition. So That's about whether different groups in society are given appropriate recognition and equal status in the public sphere, in the political sphere. And this is a subject of a debate between political philosophers, most notably Nancy Fraser and Axel Honneth. And so Fraser's position is that these are two independent and foundational aspects of a theory of justice, and you need both of them if you want to provide a satisfactory account, and you can't reduce one to the other. And then for Honneth, if you dig beneath the concerns about distribution, they're actually always about recognition. And so he believes that if you go through history, you look at, say, 19th century struggles for workers' rights, then those struggles weren't actually, as many of us might believe, motivated by a desire for more wealth or welfare, but rather from a belief that the dignity of working class people was being denigrated or disrespected. I'm personally more sympathetic to Fraser's view that these are two independent things. But I think either way, the distinction is quite a helpful way of categorizing what's at stake when we're talking about different algorithmic systems and ethical implications of them. And in most of the examples I've used here that we've been talking about are concerned with distribution of outcomes between groups. But there are also cases where it's not that the system is necessarily having direct distributive effects on people's livelihoods, you know, by keeping them in jail or denying them jobs, but rather it's about representing different groups equally. So there's a couple of well-known papers that came out a few years ago, which looked at something that is used in natural language processing called word embeddings. So word embeddings are ways of representing the position of a word in a language in relation to all the other words in the language. So, for instance, you think about the word embeddings for king and queen, they're quite similar. So they're similarly situated with respect to all of the other words in the language. But it turns out that the same is true for words like programmer and homemaker, or doctor and nurse. So actually, it turns out that when you look at these word embeddings, the gender biases of the real world are reflected in our words when you represent them in a mathematical space. So I think, borrowing from Fraser, I would like to kind of call that a case of a harm of recognition rather than a distributive one. Although, you know, it might also indirectly lead to distributive harms as well.
Yeah, and actually, you know, debates about representation and recognition are playing out in other contexts as well, which might be more familiar to people, but which I think you can build an analogy between then and the case that you're discussing there about natural language processing, you know, so debates about the representation of members of minority groups in film and media. Those are kind of concerns about representation and recognition, but maybe not so much about distribution, although there's probably a way in which you could also say that there's a distributive aspect to them too.
Right. And you mentioned Sophia Noble's book, Algorithms of Oppression, and the cover of that book has the example of search engines and the results that you get when you type different things into search engines. Like, I think the example, one of the examples is professional hair for work, and there you get examples of white women with straight hair, and if you type unprofessional hair for work, you get images of black women with natural hair.
Yeah, and I mean, there are all sorts of examples as well to do with like how ads are targeted at people. And, you know, if you type in African American names, you're more likely to get information about if you've been wrongly convicted or something like that. So like, there's ways in which these systems make assumptions about the representation of people in different classes as well, and that can affect things, and how that can affect how we perceive and understand the world as well, and can also play into long-term statistical discrimination too,
right,
and oppression. So, I mean, just to kind of quickly review this conversation about equality, there's been a number of factors that you have pointed to and that are probably important when we think about designing a fair algorithmic decision-making system. We've got the metrics of equality, you know, what is it that we're trying to equalize or distribute fairly amongst people. There are the various historical factors about how society ended up being a particular way that it is, how a certain current distribution arose. Is it through individual choice or luck? Is it because of historical oppression and unfairness? And then there's also this distinction between representational and recognitional fairness and distributive fairness. So that's a lot of things that we need to take into consideration. And we probably haven't really scratched the surface of the, you know, contention within the philosophical debate about how to properly understand these different things. I mean, what are the prospects for technologists and designers and programmers of these systems taking those things into consideration? I mean, how optimistic are you about the future of fairness in algorithmic decision making?
I mean, I think it's a very difficult thing to expect these designers to do these things all by themselves. So I think the part of the solution will be to have representation of civil society groups, to make it really easy for people to collectively challenge private and public sector uses of these technologies. And that's kind of, as much as anything else, it's about enabling political legitimacy to the use of these things, as well as getting the right answer. It's about getting the right answer in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the other aspect of your work. Now, we won't have time to explore this in any real detail. I think, you know, we've been going for an hour, so we'll probably try and wrap up the conversation pretty quickly. But I do want to give you an opportunity to say something about your views on accountability. So, you know, if there is this complexity to fairness and there are these choices and trade-offs that have to be made when designing a system, it seems like, you know, part of the solution here is going to be achieving better accountability for algorithmic decision making. So how could we go about achieving a better accountability for these systems? And I know that's a big question, but
I mean, I think it's, in practice, it's got to be partly a legal question. You know, to what extent will things like data protection law, things like equalities law, actually be adapted to deal with these systems? And I think that the seeds of bringing these systems into the purview of those areas of law are definitely there. But there needs to be kind of more concerted effort in translating these things. I think there's one kind of area that's been quite hotly explored, which is about providing explanations for the outputs of these systems. And I've done some work here where we tested out a bunch of different forms of interpretable machine learning in contexts like employment, credit scoring, insurance pricing. And we asked people, well, given these different explanations, did people think that the decisions that were made by the systems were more fair or just, or that there was a kind of a legitimate process that had been arrived at? And we kind of had mixed results. So when we showed people these explanations, kind of we gave them the same type of explanation for lots of different scenarios, and they tended to ignore the explanations that were given and just focus on the features of the case. The time when they did pay attention to the explanation was when we had different explanations side by side. And in those cases, people were often triggered by different types of explanations. So there's one type of explanation which finds an instance from the training data, which is most similar to the case in question. And it says, well, you know, John didn't get the loan. And if we look at the closest example to John in the training data, Jim, he didn't get the loan either. And that's because Jim, you know, ended up defaulting later on. And so that's the explanation as to why John hasn't got the loan. And people really didn't like that kind of explanation. So I think there's a lot of space to look at which kinds of explanations have those effects. But ultimately, I think the fairness of a system has to be assessed at an overall level, and it has to involve more than just the decision subject. It has to involve even people who aren't affected by this decision directly, but might be affected by it indirectly.
Yeah, and I suppose that, you know, that's, again, even though you were loath to use the example, we've referred to it throughout the Compass debate. You know, that's part of the question there as well, is that, you know, we as individuals may not be affected by the system, but we have to decide as a society whether this is a decision-making system that we are happy with. Are we willing to trade off the accuracy of the system against the fact that it might be perpetuating historical injustices or inequalities?
So
I will provide a link to that paper you did on the experiments, which is interesting, and also your other work on accountability and public reason in algorithmic decision making. But apart from that, I think we'll probably wrap up the conversation for today. I'd just like to thank you once again for joining me for this conversation.
Oh, thank you very much. It's very enjoyable.